Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on Captain Thunderbolt. Carol Baxter makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute, and Dr. David Roberts makes his first appearance at the Sydney Institute. It's the occasion of the publication of Captain Thunderbolt and His Lady, the true story of the bushrangers Frederick Ward and Mary Ann Bugg by Carol Baxter. And we've got two people to talk about it. Carol herself, who's adjunct lecturer at the University of New England, a fellow of the Society of Australian Genealogists, and author of An Irresistible Temptation, and Breaking the Bank, and Captain Thunderbolt and His Lady. And Dr. David Roberts, who is a senior lecturer in Australian history at the University of New England, who's editor of the Journal of Australian Colonial History, and co-editor of the book The Great Mistakes of Australian History. And both Carol Baxter and David Roberts are co-authors of the article
Exposing an expose.
That's right. Fact versus fiction in the resurrection of Captain Thunderbolt. So we're going to lead off with Carol Baxter, then we go to David Roberts, then we go to question and discussion. Carol, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Jared. It's with great pleasure that David and I speak to you tonight, as you will understand when you hear the substance of our talk. We stand before you, can you hear me enough? We stand before you with knife wounds in our backs. Admittedly, you wouldn't be able to see them, but we can feel them. We have been attacked in this way because we had the temerity to stand up and say that those who had owned the Thunderbolt debate for the last couple of decades, those who had been propagating their own version of the Thunderbolt facts, were wrong. I was advised when they found out that I was writing the book Captain Thunderbolt and His Lady that I should toe the party line, but naturally I wrote my book using the actual historical records. In the aftermath, when they couldn't fault the evidence, the message, they turned around and attempted to destroy the messenger. David became involved when he asked me to write a review of the book Thunderbolt Scourge of the Rangers, which presents their version of the Thunderbolt facts. David, at the University of New England, is of course in the heart of Thunderbolt territory, which was up in the northern area of New South Wales. So it was appropriate for the Journal of Australian Colonial History that there should be a review of this book written. David asked me to write the review, suggested 500 words. I managed to bargain up to 750, 1,000, 1,500 and 2,000 when I handed it over. And he read it. He said, oh, there's so much more that could be written about this. And I said, yes, you just wanted a review though. And he mentioned some of the local political resonances. And I said, very interesting, why don't we co-write an article? And that article was Exposing an Exposé, which has just been published. Why would a 140-year-old bushranging story generate so much interest and such an extraordinary response? And what does this response reflect about human nature and society today? That's essentially the substance of our talk. 3 years ago, I talked at the Sydney Institute about my previous book, Breaking the Bank, which was a story of Australia's largest ever bank robbery. Some of you probably attended that talk. My venture into Thunderbolt territory began when I actually rang my publisher to say that there was Hollywood film interest in Breaking the Bank, which is still grumbling along, which is fortunate. And the conversation followed on, and she said, "What are you thinking about working on next? I think you should write a story about a strong female character." And I raised the subject of female bushranger, and she thought that sounded like a good idea. So I got on the internet and Googled female bushranger. Don't you love the internet? And came across Marianne Buck, the woman who would take over my life for the next 3 years. Beautiful, educated, intelligent, feisty, and part Aboriginal. And she was the lover of the bushranger Captain Thunderbolt, the most successful bushranger in Australian history. I had found the perfect story. But as it turned out, I had found way more than a simple bushranging story. There were claims of murder, of a government cover-up, of a conspiracy of silence that had lasted 140 years. Parliament became involved, and the press reported on the stories all over Australia and as far away as England. But first, before I go into all of that, let me talk about Fred and Marianne. Fred was born in 1835 in Windsor. He was the son of a convict called Michael Ward and his wife Sophia. Fred was more interested in droving with his older brothers than in receiving an education, and he obviously learned his skills well at a very young age. At the age of 11, he was employed as the only guard and guide to a truck-driving city clerk, his pregnant wife, their one-year-old son, their nursemaid, and a 15-year-old schoolboy, to take them all the way 240 miles from Morpeth to Armidale, 11 years old. Can you imagine it today? I have a son, 20, forget it. So, this was an interesting, capable child who also showed an interest in bushrangers at the time. He took the other schoolboy to Doughboy Hollow and showed him the bullet holes in the tree that had been there since there was a shootout between the police and a bushranger called the Jew Boy. So, this capable lad had an interest in bushrangers, but why did he become a bushranger himself? In 1856, when he was about 20, he was enticed by his conman nephew to participate in a horse-stealing operation, a very large horse-stealing operation, in fact. He was arrested, convicted, and sentenced to 10 years imprisonment on Cockatoo Island, which was the hell hole prison at that time. So Fred behaved well, and after 4 years, he was given a ticket of leave, which is the colonial version of a parole pass, and he went to Mudgee. And it was at Mudgee that he met Marianne Bugg. Marianne was one of a kind in colonial New South Wales, a fascinating character in her own right. She was the daughter of a convict father and an Aboriginal mother, but theirs was not the usual frontier exploitative relationship. They were devoted to each other. Her mother actually fired a musket at some Aboriginal men who were attacking his father with a view to killing him, and he tried to marry her and couldn't do so until eventually a clergyman would agree to do so. They had 8 children, Marianne being the first, and they decided that they wanted their children brought up away from the savagery of the tribes. So they paid, now this is a convict overseer, they paid for Marianne to be sent to Sydney and receive a schooling. And for 5 years she was educated in Sydney. When she was about 10, she came back to the Gloucester district, which is where her family lived. And there for the next few years she was educated by her mother in Aboriginal bushways. So Marianne, as the only Aboriginal woman at that time, received both a thorough white education and a thorough black education. She was a chameleon who could exist in both worlds, and as such she was the ideal partner for a man who would ultimately become a bushranger. Marianne fell pregnant within a month or so of their meeting, and Fred decided to take her home to a family at Dungog for her confinement. He had to attend a muster every 3 months. So he returned to Mudgee, but he was late for the muster, and unfortunately he compounded his problem by riding in on a stolen horse. So his ticket of leave was revoked and he was sent back to Cockatoo Island to serve the 6 years of his sentence, the remaining 6 years. And he had another added 3 years added on for the horse receiving conviction, horse possession conviction. 9 years on Cockatoo Island with no possibility of any remissions. Fred, 2 years later, took his future into his own hands, and with another convict on the island, he escaped from Cockatoo Island. He collected Mary Ann and they headed north, and he then roamed for 6.5 years under the moniker Captain Thunderbolt. He covered the territory from the Hunter Valley up southern Queensland and out west as far as Bourke, often alone, sometimes with what were called apprentices, teenage boys who assisted him, sometimes with gangs. And his denouement came in May 1870 when he was caught by a constable out near Euralla and he was shot. And Euralla since then has commemorated Thunderbolt. It's a great tourist attraction. There's a museum for Thunderbolt and there's a huge life-size statue of Thunderbolt. So, as it probably seems to you and as it is, it's a relatively straightforward story. Why would these people want to knife us in the back? When I research true stories, I use secondary source records, books, articles, etc. And I use those as stepping stones back to the original records. Things like birth, marriage and death certificates, jail and court records, official correspondence, newspapers, etc. And one of the things I noticed when I was looking at these secondary sources was that there were a huge amount of conflict between the accounts in the different sources. Now, I've often noticed that historical accounts are riddled with errors. It's actually quite frightening when you examine something like this and realise how much of our history is wrong. And part of the reason is because so many historians, rather than doing the research themselves, assume that their predecessor has done the research. So they just copy what their predecessor did. But unfortunately, their predecessor assumed that their predecessor had done the research and copied that. And so the mistakes spread like a virus throughout books and articles and now the internet, to the point that it's actually extremely difficult to eradicate some of the errors. For example, a bushranging history published in the early 1900s called Mary Ann Yellow Long. Yellow Long was the nickname of the other woman, as you will discover when you read my book. But Mary Ann and this nickname Yellow Long have been so closely entwined in so many publications that the odds of separating them are negligible. When I looked at the original records, I found that the actual facts were quite easy to ascertain with a bit of work, and the errors were quite obvious. When I compared them back, these facts and errors, with the secondary sources I had looked at, I determined that one particular person was responsible for the errors, a family historian. I have worked in the family history industry, in the genealogy industry, for 30 years, so I'm well aware that most family historians are untrained amateurs. Some of them do a wonderful job. Some of them make a complete botch of it. And for some reason, the people who make a complete botch of it are the ones who always seem to be determined to publish it on Ancestry.com. So everyone else then suffers from the botch. Now, what I had thought before was bad research paled into insignificance compared to this material I had found about Thunderbolt. This particular researcher had managed to get pretty much everything wrong about Fred and Mary Ann. Fred's birth, parentage, he and Mary Ann's relationship, their marriage, their children, their death, and pretty much everything in between. Couldn't have done a worse job if he tried. The errors were spreading into books, magazines, articles, websites, even into an academic thesis, and the culmination came in 2009 with the publication of the book Thunderbolt Scourge of the Ranges. This book contained all of these errors and many more besides, and it had a very interesting overarching theme. The theme was this conspiracy that Thunderbolt did not die in 1870, that a ruthless constable shot the wrong man, that he announced that he had shot Thunderbolt before the body had been officially identified, that the news spread via the press before, again, the body had been identified. And when the police realised that they had shot the wrong man, they decided, with the help of the authorities in Sydney, to cover it all up. This is what the book says. Meanwhile, Fred was seen at the races at Glen Innes, and some troopers spotted him, and they wrote a report, but the report was buried. In the aftermath, he escaped to America and died in Canada. These sensational claims were published in a work of fiction. They could be dismissed as fanciful, but the authors announced in the press that the book was based on fact, that this was all true and that they could prove it. They even invited people to come and check the records themselves, which interestingly David did. Did he find that they could prove it? No. They also said that they needed the help of the politicians because they needed the authorities to release documents that had been hidden for 140 years as part of this big conspiracy of silence. It was the shabbiest official cover-up in our sad, inauspicious history, said the book Thunderbolt Scourge of the Rangers. They particularly wanted the police reports about the Glen Innes races and the sighting of Fred then. They approached their local parliamentarians, National Party's Richard Collis, then the Deputy Opposition Whip, and Nationals leader Andrew Stoner became involved. They used Standing Order 53, a permanent rule of procedure enabling documents to be demanded from the New South Wales Governor in relation to the administration of justice. Collis stated in the press that he had grown up with stories that cast doubt on the official version of Thunderbolt's death, that he felt it to be a matter of history and correcting the record, and that he would be surprised if it doesn't turn up something interesting. Stoner similarly thought it in the best interests of our democracy and good governance to break through the wall of silence. Asked for his comment, the Labor Police Minister, Michael Daly, wryly noted that the Police Integrity Commissioner might find it difficult to question the investigating officers. The full details of this parliamentary demand are covered in our article, Exposing an Exposé. And for time constraint reasons, I can only cover a few points. But let me look at a couple of them that are considered very important as part of this conspiracy, Thunderbolt conspiracy. First of all, the identification of the dead bush ranger in 1870. The Scourge authors claim that Constable Walker announced that he had shot Thunderbolt, that the news was sent to the top brass before the body had been officially identified at the magisterial inquiry. But the records show that Walker did not name the bushranger at the time, at the magisterial inquiry or before then, and that the name of the bushranger, the identity of the bushranger, was released only after the body had been officially identified. Now, how can we determine this? Because the time and date was listed on the telegrams that were published in the press across Australia. And thankfully, due to the Trove newspapers online, we can actually get all the reports and compare them. And they say the same thing and the time and date is the same. So we know that the body wasn't named until after the magisterial inquiry. The identification was actually made by witnesses who knew him and by comparing the physical features on the dead bushranger with the reward notice that was published after his escape from Cockatoo Island. Three people made the comparisons, two policemen and an autopsy doctor, and they testified under oath that these features tallied exactly. The features, let me list them for you. Height, 8 feet and 1/4 inch. Fair complexion, brown curly hair, grey or hazel grey eyes, a small mole on the back of the right arm a little above the wrist, and two warts on the back of the middle finger of the left hand. Pretty conclusive identification, I think you will think, you will realise. What do the Scourge authors say? They all lied. What about the claim that Fred was spotted on his horse Combo at the Glen Innes races on 28th of May 1870, 3 days after Fred Ward died, and that a hidden police report to that effect exists? This document was the one most crucial to proving their conspiracy theory, according to the Scourge authors themselves. The single document most capable of unravelling the whole plot against Thunderbolt is what they wrote. Well, Fred might indeed have been seen at the Glen Innes races, and the police might indeed have written a report to that effect, but it couldn't possibly have been on the 28th of May 1870, because the Glen Innes races were an annual event that were held at the end of March each year, not May. Perhaps the person who claims he saw the document and then admits he buried it misread March or MAR as May, if such a document ever existed. It has not turned up despite an exhaustive search by State Records of New South Wales staff and other people like myself. What about the claim that Fred Ward was seen in America and died in Canada? They say that he is listed in the 1870 California census and that he also has a headstone in Ottawa Cemetery. The 1870 census and the Ontario Death Register Index are available on ancestry.com. Many of people have searched for them, including David and myself, and there are no entries there for Fred Ward or anyone who could have been the erstwhile bushranger. So, despite the fact that the historical record provides no support for their conspiracy claims and in fact proves unequivocally that the bushrangers shot in 1870 was Fred Ward, the Legislative Council agreed to the demand under Standing Order 53 on 18th of March 2010. The New South Wales Governor was ordered to release the documents. However, the Lieutenant Governor, Jim Spiegelman, on the advice of the Executive Council, rejected the order on the grounds that the documents predate Federation and therefore could have no bearing on the current government of New South Wales. He also stated that colonial records are freely available at State Records and that it is inappropriate for members of the Legislative Council to use Parliament's constitutional powers to undertake this research for them. It was a just rebuke. So what did the Scourge authors say? That the cover-up continues and now reaches as high as the office of the current New South Wales Governor, the Honourable Mari Bashir, who, as any of you know, is a passionate advocate of Australian history and the last person to be involved in such a cover-up. Anyway, the Lieutenant Governor was correct. These documents have been available on open access for decades. I had accessed them prior to the parliamentary demand was made. Other Thunderbolt writers had researched them, had found them in the 1960s and the 1970s. Incredibly, the Scourge authors seem to be the only ones who hadn't seen them, which is in itself evidence of their ineptitude as researchers. But, as it turned out, State Records of New South Wales had already begun gathering the material. They figured that Thunderbolt was an important enough historical figure, so they would collect this material again together and publish, you know, make it available at State Records in Kingswood and up at the University of New England so that people could access the information for themselves. What did the Scourge authors say when the material they had demanded was produced and showed that the dead bushranger was indeed Fred Ward? That the documents were forged, amended, written under duress, and so on, and that the cover-up still continues. The Scourge authors have positioned themselves in such a way that they can declare that both the evidence and the lack of evidence proves their claims. If documents are produced showing that the dead bushranger was Fred Ward, then they claim that the documents must have been falsified, which is evidence of a cover-up. If documents that show the dead bushranger was not Fred Ward are not produced, then they claim that these have been hidden away as part of the cover-up. Unfortunately, the Lieutenant Governor found himself an unwitting player in their little game. He, by refusing Parliament's demand for the release of these documents, he provided them with grounds for declaring that we live in the type of regime that allows the wishes of our elected government to be overridden, the type of the regime that would institute and maintain such a cover-up. So how do we break this absurd cycle? We turn the spotlight away from Thunderbolt and focus it on the conspiracy theorists themselves. That's where David comes in. Thank you.
So we continue our discussion, Captain Thunderbolt, Myth and History, with David. David Roberts, off you go, I think.
Great, thank you. All right, okay. Thanks, everyone. So Carol's given a little bit of a broad overview of the substance of the Thunderbolt conspiracy theory, or the, I suppose, the lack of substance, as it were. And she's briefly outlined the grounds on which we have demonstrated and declared this to be entirely bogus. What I'd like to do is elaborate with some further comments on how this theory has been propagated and how it has been defended against our efforts to expose it as utter nonsense. As Carol indicated, from the moment we began examining the nature and provenance of this conspiracy, we have found ourselves subjected to an extraordinary array of attacks, both private and in public, and these are attacks on our credibility and our competence. And I'm using this occasion to sort of answer some of those criticisms. It's an experience that has caused us to reflect on vital issues concerning the nature and practice of history and the obligations of the historian. Essentially, what we're combating here is a form of what is broadly and pejoratively known as pseudo-history. That is, a seriously suspect interpretation that postures as historical revisionism, involving the denouncement of well-known and firmly established historical facts and themes, which are refuted in the face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary. Pseudo-history takes many forms, and it has many defining tenets, some of them extremely ugly. But they do tend to be pervaded by notions of conspiracy. That is, that they are unmasking a conspiracy or they are fighting to reveal knowledge and truths that are conspiratorially hidden. The Thunderbolt conspiracy has been disseminated and defended through a number of avenues, and I'm going to briefly discuss and comment on each of these. I'd like to suggest that the medium and manner in which it has been promoted has been particularly instructive, but it's also rather disconcerting, in that this theory has been accorded a degree of credibility and recognition that is entirely undeserved, and this is worrying for what it suggests about the future of fact and truth in our current society. So there is first and foremost the 2009 book, Scourge of the Rangers, and this is the primary and best packaged manifestation of the conspiracy theory. As Carol indicated, it's actually a very problematic target because it is deliberately and declaredly a work of historical fiction. And as such, it protects itself from many of our criticisms. Most of our criticisms are sort of in the nature of, the practice of history as a sober scholarly discipline. But this novel does contain very clear assertions that it is using the techniques of historical fiction to tell a true story. And certainly this is the way it was positioned in the press. The authors claim to be pursuing a hidden and suppressed history, employing fictional narrative as a convenient or persuasive medium. And this medium, they say, was necessary to fill the gaps in information caused by the government's failure to release secret documents. Now, these sort of mixed messages are interesting because in the United States, for example, false history is protected as a freedom of speech under the Bill of Rights. However, there have been successful cases in state courts in the US brought against publishers who fraudulently advertise fiction as fact. And this is considered can be considered a type of commercial fraud or false advertising. Now, there's no space to explore this here, but it would be interesting to know how this particular book would stand up to such procedures, given the sort of publicity that surrounded the book in which it was announced to be factual. The main point here is that these claims, the claims that the book is a quest for an historical truth that has been blocked by powerful vested interests, is just errant and self-serving nonsense. The novel is entirely fantasised. It bears absolutely no relationship to anything that is known or provable, and there are not even any reasonable grounds for suspecting that the story is in any way accurate or even close to accurate. I think I'll put that rather forcefully. So that was the first means, is the book. The second means, as Carol mentioned, was the peculiar means of having the New South Wales Legislative Council use Standing Order Number 53 to demand the release of supposedly state-censored documents, which were going to prove this conspiracy. This attracted enormous and long-running publicity, particularly up in the New England where I'm from. It ran quite uncontested for a very, very long period of time. And this did a lot to cement the conspiracy theory in the popular imagination. And it also, no doubt, advanced sales of the book. Nothing was done by politicians or the media to verify the claims made in this book. And I'm going to return to that point just in a moment. Another means used to propagate and preserve the conspiracy was more typical of the age in which we live, and that is the medium of a website. It's not a particularly good website, but if you type in Captain Thunderbolt into a Google search, this particular website appears third on the list. Now, thankfully, the first on the list goes to the very reputable piece in the Australian Dictionary of Biography. But in between the two, there is, of course, the Wikipedia entry. And that itself has become something of a battleground for the conflicting versions of Thunderbolt. And you can imagine what it's like. Both sides are seeking to constantly delete and override each other's entries. And this is something that Carol's been party to. She sort of looked into it, so she might get to talk about that later. The internet epitomises, and it's very much a primary cause of, I think, a modern crisis in truth. It has accelerated the democratisation of history, but it's also magnified its perils and pitfalls. The internet is the easiest, fastest and cheapest publication tool the world has ever known, and it allows false information to spread more widely and more quickly than was ever possible at any time in our history. It allows false information to spread free of the geographic, financial or institutional restraints which might once have controlled the production and impact of knowledge. So in revolutionising our access to information, it has also presented us with a cacophony of bullshit. Okay, so the final means of promoting and defending the conspiracy theory has involved the writing of letters, both personal letters and emails to Carol and myself, and there have been hundreds. But also letters to our colleagues, to high-level administrators at the University of New England, letters to the regional press, which are particularly galling because these are the sorts of things that are hard to left unanswered. Everything else we've largely ignored. They bombarded the peer-reviewed journal in which our work appeared. They continue to address members of parliament, civil servants, and anyone who they apparently believe has the authority to promote their case or to denigrate ours. Through this medium, they doggedly maintain that there remains a grievous conspiracy to suppress the true story of Captain Thunderbolt. As Carol said, they hold up the rejection of the parliamentary motion as ongoing proof of a conspiracy. And they maintain that this has caused some sort of constitutional crisis where politicians are caught between the demands of their constituents on the one hand and the pressure to maintain the integrity of the state on the other. In actual fact, the issue has simply come and gone, and we think that the politicians who briefly humoured this idea have probably now realised that there was nothing in it. Moreover, they actually claim that we are now party to this conspiracy, that we are using the mantle of academic respectability to subvert the quest for truth, to chook-feed government misinformation to an unsuspecting public. And so we are thus aiding the process of keeping Australians under what one of them called an insidious state of neo-serfdom. I'm not entirely sure what that is. They continue to hammer away at a number of points that they regard as decisive, that the identification of the body was circumstantial, that the bushranger was sighted a few days after his death, and that US census records show him as residing in California in the late 19th century. They throw up a number of other smaller points that are somewhat peripheral, small matters that they believe contradict or complicate our bigger picture. But almost everything they say is demonstrably untrue, or is at best wildly speculative. And I think the problem we're facing here essentially is that these conspiracy theorists hold themselves up to be the arbiters of truth, you know, irrespective of what evidence we present them, irrespective of what can be proven or disproven. Basically, we're all wrong because they know better. And ensuing from this and binding their whole offensive together is the constant refrain that we are bad historians. We have brought ourselves, our institution and the whole profession into disrepute. We haven't done our research. We have based our findings on hearsay rather than archives. And we have tailored our work to meet a preconceived and politicised outcome. There's also been some sort of insinuations that we forged documents and fabricated references. And all of this has been levelled against us without any hint of irony or self-reflection. And also with brazen hypocrisy, they claim that we have acted aggressively and offensively and that we've insulted their personal and professional integrity. So these have been the four main means of propagating this conspiracy: a self-published novel, the conning of a few politicians, a website, and a barrage of letters to anyone who they think might be interested. What's missing here, of course, is the subjection of any of these ideas to any sort of peer review or professional editing. So, in sum, I want to just reiterate that we believe that the conspiracy theory is based on an astonishingly poor grasp of the methods of historical research and practice. It includes the selective use of facts, the misrepresentation of facts, and indeed the invention of facts. And it does these to advance very misleading and preposterous assertions. And its propagation of this in light of our attacks on it have involved a number of techniques. 2 minutes. Their techniques include the misrepresentation of other people's arguments, the avoidance of key truths via the complication of simple facts, false claims of scholarly credibility, appeals to the broader public via the media, bullying and badgering of critics, and accusations against us of incompetence and rudeness. Now, broadly speaking, these are the techniques that are common to pseudo-history, including its most abusive form, which is negationism, or as in history denial, Holocaust denial. Pseudo-history thrives on distortion and deception, if not delusion, and its proponents tend to exhibit common personality traits, including stubbornness, paranoia, and grandiosity. Now, I'm not suggesting that we are dealing with anything here so odious as Holocaust denial. The Thunderbolt conspiracy is obviously not unspeakably offensive to victims and descendants of past atrocities, nor is it potentially dangerous in assisting the revival of political extremism. And the other point, of course, is that Holocaust denial has become eerily sophisticated these days in the way in which it mimics real history. The Thunderbolt conspiracy, in contrast, is marked by its ineptitude and extreme implausibility. In fact, it's probably more reflective of the so-called Dunning-Kruger effect, which is a cognitive bias in which individuals maintain an illusory sense of self-superiority, causing them to be completely oblivious to their own ineptitude and mistakes, and wholly unable to accept the skill and expertise of others. This would explain some of the most bizarre, illogical, contradictory and impertinent reasoning and practices that I have ever encountered in 20 years as an historian. Now, thankfully in Australia, we don't have the sort of cultural crises that might require us to criminalise the production of history, of the sort that has in numerous European countries, particularly France, resulted in memory laws. And even if we did, I mean, Thunderbolt conspiracy could hardly be seen to be requiring legislative or judicial intervention. I mean, that would give it a credibility that it doesn't deserve. But just finally, it does have lessons and perhaps reveals something unsettling about the state of truth in our contemporary world. The Thunderbolt conspiracy that should be entertained as plausible by anyone is truly shocking, but I think in this case the culpability lies with the con artist rather than the conned. Of those who are conned, I think it's the media and the politicians who must take some share of the responsibility. Their gullible consumption of this nonsense speaks very badly of their willingness to promote and pursue populist rubbish at the expense of truth. Now, we're dealing here with a very minor and inconsequential aspect of our old colonial past. But there are today greater and more serious matters facing us where myth and misinformation are allowed to cloud our decision-making. We face a crisis of truth in our society. As I said, it's epitomised by the internet where, you know, fact and fantasy are separated by one click of the button. But there's also a cultural angst, I think, where we are unable to be assured, for example, of whether or not human activity is causing climate change or whether we are going to war on false pretences, because we just can't trust that our leaders are not prepared to embrace this sort of stuff. We just don't know always what to believe and who to trust. And in a very minor but telling way, the Thunderbolt conspiracy reflects this crisis, both in its devious production of false information, but also in the readiness of people to endorse it and of others to believe it. And in this climate, I suggest that we should not so easily disrespect and disregard the expert opinion of those who were trained to detect bullshit. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, there are copies of the real thing, Captain Thunderbolt and his lady, the true story of the Bush Rangers, Frederick Ward and Mary Ann Bugg, and Janet Grundy's got some copies of the real thing. So we come to question discussion. We've got plenty of time. I don't want to be unfair. I mean, I grew up in Victoria and we had Ned Kelly, and New South Wales had Captain Thunderbolt. But usually in conspiracy theories there are big issues involved, like the Kennedy assassination conspiracy theory, but where all sorts of people are involved, from Fidel Castro to the CIA to LB Johnson and Marilyn Monroe and the whole works. But why should anyone really bother about when Captain Thunderbolt died? I mean, what does it really matter? Because it's why the excitement? Is this just sort of pride about someone thinking they had the facts when they didn't have the facts, or is there something bigger in it than that?
One of the fascinating things I learned when I started researching Thunderbolt is that the New England district owns Thunderbolt in the same way that Australia perhaps owns Don Bradman. There's a sense of possession and importance because every talk I have given, except one, there has been somebody in the audience with some connection with this story. They either have had a family member who had some Thunderbolt story, or they're related or to Thunderbolt, or related to another figure in the Thunderbolt story. Just as a test here, somebody here got a Thunderbolt connection? Anyone? Here we've got a Thunderbolt connection. See what I mean? So there's this fascination with Thunderbolt. And there is this fascination, therefore, it's quite a broad fascination. Now, Gerard's from Melbourne, as he says, so he wasn't brought up in the tales of Thunderbolt. But people have this interest in him. So they were very interested in all these claims about Thunderbolt. And part of the claims, I think the fascination with Thunderbolt, is this whole question of us versus them in terms of authority. It was very much the case in the 1860s that the community supported the bushrangers then against the authority figures who they saw as elitist and, of course, are wealthy and suppressing them and all of that sort of thing. And you can almost see this now in the support in and the belief by an amazing number of people that this conspiracy theory is correct, that there is truth to the claims. And so, again, it isn't so much the fact that the story, it's what it represents about the psyche of the community. And it's quite, David and I perceive it as being quite frightening in many ways. The determination of many people to believe false history, irrespective of the evidence. In fact, I had a radio interview today and they said to me, so there's two different versions of the facts. And I said, well, you can't have two different versions of the facts. There's one fact and it's right or wrong. There can be interpretations, but in this case, there is no interpretation. So I think it is a minor story that has been completely blown up by becoming parliamentary involvement. If it had remained just a small story in a fictional novel, in a novel, then it wouldn't be important. But Parliament gave it a credence that has meant that a lot of people are believing this story to be true. Does that answer the question?
So they want Thunderbolt to live on.
Yes, yes. It's a fascinating part of the outlaw hero mythology. There's an Australian academic called Graham Seal who wrote a book called Outlaw Legend. And what he did is he explored outlaw heroes from all around the world and he determined that there were 10 different motives that are typical of the outlaw heroes, including the Robin Hood, rob the rich and not the poor. One of them, I discussed them all in Captain Thunderbolt and His Lady, but one of the ones is that they are desperate for the person, the outlaw hero, to have lived on, to have defied authority, because it's this us versus them, that the outlaw hero represented the community and was brought down in his prime by the authorities. So again, it's this political attitude of us versus them that you could see in the past in our old history, and astonishingly is still here today. And it's also seen in the broader community's willingness to disbelieve the authority figures over things like climate change and the other things. The fact that so much of this, there's so much uncertainty now about what authority figures are saying.
There's a question down the back and then down here. Yeah, don't stand up, just here. Yeah. Okay.
First of all, I have to remind you, I'm being an ex-Hall boy, because that's Ben Hall.
Yes, yes.
Well, Ben Hall's still alive, isn't he?
As is Ned Kelly.
I've seen that. About 1955 or 56, I read a rather bad book by Rolf Boldwood, called Robbery
Under Arms. Yep.
And as a 4-year-old boy, it was a wonderful story, first that sort of story that I read, I guess. And I can still remember it, and I've read a lot of books in between. called Ben Clifton. Fred Ward was the sort of gentleman bushranger, according to Robert Under Arms. And there's a comment toward the end that said, some say that he survived and went to America to live. That's, you know, over the 50-odd years intervening, seems to have been...
Okay, we better... Yeah. So the suggestion in Robbery Under Arms that he lived on.
Yes.
Some say that.
Yes, some say.
And we all wanted him to because he was a nice guy.
Okay.
Exactly, yeah. So, yes, these claims have been around for a very long time, and it appears that they came initially into the mythology from these sort of secondary source books, claims of people who want their 15 minutes of fame. You know how many people have a vicarious connection with somebody famous or infamous, and it's blown up into some major story that when you get to the nutting down of the truth, there's very little in it. Well, it's very much these claims. Somebody says this because they want their 15 minutes of fame, and the whole thing is blown out of all proportion. These things now, in the past they were very difficult to substantiate, but now with so many historical records that are readily available, it's very easy to determine the truth. And again, remember, go back to those points of identification I listed of Fred Ward, down to the mole and two warts in very specific places. It's as conclusive as fingerprinting. There's no two ways that he didn't live on. What that reflects, I think mythology reflects very much the community psyche. It doesn't reflect the facts. And it's worth exploring for that in terms of what it reflects about the community psyche.
So we go Lindsay Ann and then here. Yeah, Lindsay.
I don't claim to be a historian or an expert on writing or anything, but there seems in the last generation to be a field of authorship by people like Mike Carlton, Peter Fitzsimons, where they get a basic factual matrix and sex it up, and they're all bestsellers. Is that something to be encouraged, or if people approach it knowing what they're reading, is it good that more people are learning about Australian history? Is that something that concerns you, that there's this emotional, fictional overlay on the basic factual base? How's that fit in?
The question is sexing up history good for history?
It's one of those interesting questions, isn't it? As a historian myself, I don't like fictionalised history. There's no way of determining where on the spectrum of fact to fiction that author has, you know, positioned themselves. And people tend to assume that fictionalised history is probably 80% fact, where it's more likely 1% fact. If you think about how much dialogue is in fictionalised history and how much, and all the dialogue, almost all is made up, particularly in Thunderbolt, Scourge of the Rangers, for example, it's made up. And how much Thunderbolt, how much dialogue carries character, dialogue reflects character. I have a real problem. The way I actually write history is I write what's called narrative non-fiction, and the dialogue actually comes from the original records. So I personally don't like it. But on the other hand, I'm well aware that other people do. And so it's that question of, is it worthwhile doing it because it sells books and introduces people to history? And if you're not a purist, then I guess it is. So it depends on what you think. I mean, it's worth David, as an academic, having a response to this question.
So what does the editor
well
of the Journal of Colonial History think about this?
Oh, yeah. I'm extremely envious of Thomas Keneally and or Fitzsimons and all the others. I mean, they probably spend as much time writing as a book as I do a short article that very, very few people read. But I think it does have a very, very strong place in history. Doesn't mean it's always done well, and some do it better than others, but sexy history gets Australians interested in their past, and I enjoy reading it myself. And most of them come and join UNE to study history, and it's very much to be applauded. But it doesn't mean that they always get it right. That's certainly the case. Mm.
I just want to check. You did say he was 8 foot tall?
No.
Six foot.
I heard you say 8 foot.
Yeah. Sorry, my lord. Did I say 8 foot?
8 foot, yeah.
Did, yeah.
Did I thought, if that's the case, how many other 8 foot tall people are around New South Wales?
Yeah.
Obvious one,
5'8" and a quarter inches. My apologies.
That's okay, I just want to clear that up.
Obviously a typo that.
Okay,
Right, so there's a question here, then here, then here. Yeah, we've got to hurry. Yep. Right.
I'm a Ned Kelly fan myself, but when I lived at the University of New England, I was told that the great thing about Thunderbolt was he never killed anybody. And the other thing is, reading a recent history, some years ago history of Cockatoo Island, there was a claim that there was a man who died in hospital out here in Lincoln, the old people's home, in 1907, who was actually Fred Wood.
Mm. Yes, we actually know where those claims came from, and, well, particularly the claim that Fred died in the Lidcombe, I think it was 1937 actually. They came from a work of fiction written by a woman called Annie Rickson, who is another perfect example of what has happened with the Scourge book. It's fiction pretending to be fact, loudly, vociferously claimed to be fact, but is actually fiction, and there's no substance to it at all. Again, very, very easy to disprove. But the claims made in this work of fiction have now gone into the historical record, to the extent that there is a plaque in Balmain commemorating Fred's escape from Cockatoo Island to Balmain, but guess what? He didn't go to Balmain. He went to Woolwich. That's what the records show anyway. So, I mean, and that came out of this work of fiction.
She was actually one of our former students.
So did he kill anyone?
Definitely not. He was the gentleman bushranger, and he was clever enough to know that he had to adhere to these outlaw hero motives in order to stay with the community support. Fred was the longest surviving bushranger with 6.5 years pipped to the post 1 month ago by Malcolm Naden. So I had the radio interview this morning was about Malcolm Naden and the comparison with Thunderbolt. And in fact, when you read my book, you can understand an awful lot about Malcolm Naden because the parallels are actually quite extraordinary. But no, Fred perhaps was a rotten shot, but I've worked out there were 5 instances where he shot at people. One was the final day where he was killed. But he had worked out that if he did kill anyone, he was a smart man. He knew he would go to the gallows and he would lose the community support that enabled him to survive.
Okay, now hang on just a second. There's a question over here. Yeah?
What were the nature of the books that the authors of Scourge of the Rangers wrote before they wrote Scourge of the Rangers?
Nothing. Self-published. One's a family historian, one was a wannabe chaser writer, so an architect.
Mm. Okay, there's a question here still.
I have to declare my interest. I'm the great-grandson of Constable Walker.
Congratulations, a very, very able constable.
So he's the great-grandson of Constable Walker, right.
Yeah. We were brought up to believe that Fred was a very poor type. I've got a niggle about the captaincy in Captain Thunderbolt. In 1970, at the centenary, the Armidale Examiner or whatever put out a 24-page supplement, reproduced a lot of original documents there. In all of those documents, he's referred to as plain old Thunderbolt, not Captain Thunderbolt. And I've got this niggle that there might be a bit of a myth and sexing up of history introducing this captaincy subsequently.
Okay, so was he a captain?
He was a self-anointed captain. The first time he actually ever used the name Thunderbolt was on the 22nd of December 1863, 2 months after he escaped from Cockatoo Island, when he robbed a toll bar at Rutherford near Maitland, and he announced himself at that point as being Captain Thunderbolt. And that is from the actual reports at the time of the robbery by the person who was robbed by Thunderbolt. So we know that that is primary source history. It's not a moniker that was attached to him later on by somebody or another. But interestingly, he seemed to have lost it later on. It wasn't used as much.
There was also a deliberate decision made. A deliberate decision made at the time of the centenary to sort of downplay the hero worship of Thunderbolt and to elevate the constable. Constable Walker was the man who shot Thunderbolt, to elevate his status as being someone who sort of stood up for the community. And that decision, I think, sort of reflected local politics all those years ago, which are still being played out now. Just an interesting point.
Question.
here and then Ellen, yeah? We don't have a lot of time, yeah?
Was he contemplative of Ned Kelly? Did he have any political ambitions like Ned did?
The question was he contemporary of Ned Kelly? Ned Kelly was in the late 1870s, and he was a bit of an aberration, really, in terms of the bushranging time frame. The bushranging epidemic in New South Wales was in the 1860s, and Fred long pushed the window of that by surviving until 1870. No, he really didn't have any political aspirations, although this is what the whole thesis of this book is, Thunderbolt Scourge of the Ranges. The only time in the records I found that he actually, there were a couple of things, but one of them where he showed support for the poor, well, the ordinary person, was that he robbed a mail bag, and when he pulled out the stuff, he ripped up all the bills that were being sent to people. But that was as far as... yeah, that was as far as it was. I mean, it was pure self-interest that kept him there.
Hang on a second. David, do you want to...
Well, he certainly didn't write it.
Just come into the middle.
Thunderbolt certainly didn't write a Giraldry letter. There was no sort of manifestation. No, I think it was essentially just a hoodlum.
Yeah.
There's a question. Ellen, yes.
Now, you mentioned an organisation called the Jew Boy Gang. That interested me because in the 1986, during the visit of Pope John Paul, the Jewish community had to decide on an appropriate present to give to the Pope. And there was this book which had been lying around for a long time about the Jew Boy Gang. And with some trepidation, they decided they would give this book as the official Jewish gift to the Pope. But I was in
seems a bizarre gift to me.
I was in the presence of the reporters on that occasion, and I sort of looked at the Pope most carefully to see, you know, what reaction he would have to the book, but there was no visible.
I think I'll quote Tony Jones and say I'll take that as a comment.
Right, yeah, Tom.
Could I put a proposition to you that irrespective of whether your office was factual or otherwise, the mere fact that you've generated a new narrative has fed the psyche of the people in that region and has fueled this whole epidemic of interest from them?
The suggestion is if there's psychosis rampant in New England, then you're to blame.
Well, Carol's to blame. I came into the question rather late. I think the situation is that a lot of this nonsense has been going around for a long time.
Very nasty.
It's been very nasty. There's been fisticuffs in the streets and people accosting tourist buses to put their various sides of the story.
Unbelievable.
But it's also been largely uncontested professionally or academically, and I think when Carol's book came out and some of the research started to be released, these people sort of reacted the way they have always done, which is through bullying and badging and asking for resignations and stuff. We'd like to think that this time they've met their match.
Small though I am, and not so small David, they didn't know what they met.
Well, we're sticking to our guns.
Yeah, that's right.
I think it's final question. Lindsay Ellison, yeah.
Carol started, and you've just finished by talking about these people and they. Are we talking about academics, local municipal officials, family historians? I mean, the people's professional reputations at stake. What's the...
So who are the people you're...
Well, obviously not naming any names. We're certainly not talking about academics or scholars. We're talking about enthusiasts. I think it's probably the best. Yeah, so essentially from the community. People, for whatever reason, have invested so much energy and passion into this and have finally found something that they can really fight about and make a noise for themselves. I think that's probably the best way to put it.
Maybe the descendants of
War? Associates. One's a relative, others aren't.
So since we're all discussing this, there's a final comment from both of you. I mean, conspiracy theories aside, why should we know something about Ward? I mean, why is Thunderbolt an important figure in New South Wales or Australian history?
One of the fascinating factors, we learn history part of the reason because it gives us messages. It tells us how to act in the present, hopefully, and not make the same mistakes of the past, how not to act. When I was researching Thunderbolt, I was exploring what the community's attitude was to Thunderbolt, particularly the establishment. And having done two previous convict books and listening to what the establishment said, in the 1820s with the previous convict books, the establishment said that the people were criminals because they chose to be criminals, because they chose not to work and preferred not to work hard to get a living. They preferred to steal. It was easier. We move forward to 40 years to the Thunderbolt bushranging period, and we look at what the establishment said. And the establishment said that these people chose to be bushrangers, that they could have worked hard, but they found it easier to rob the highways and rob the people of their money. So there's this real attitude of choosing. The establishment means that people choose, or tries to say that people choose their behaviour. And I talked about this in actually the author's note at the back of the book. And I wrote the author's note in, and unfortunately I could just read what I wrote in the author's note. Don't have enough time. Okay, I basically said that the disenfranchised choose to make their unhappiness known, essentially with a very loud voice, in a way that the community gets to hear whether they want to or not and whether they support it or not. A few months after I wrote that, there was the London riots. Now, what was the comment that came out of the establishment? That they chose to do it, that they used the mobile phones and that they used the social network, etc., etc. It was that word choice again. And what I think we can all determine from the London riots, for example, was that there are an awful lot of very angry people in England, and it crosses social boundaries. And so there's messages in history. And the fascinating messages in Thunderbolt is a community with no political voice who supported people who were doing bad things, because they actually provided a voice. And you see this around the world. You see it with things like the Taliban and some of the other groups like that, community supporting people. So the story of Thunderbolt, to me, and any history like that, is very important in what it tells us about society and society's attitudes.
David, final comment?
It's important because history is good. It was a formative period in the making of New South Wales. It's important because it still has resonances, people still remember it, people still discuss it and debate it. But yeah, basically at the end of the day, it's just interesting because it's our history, and it's important to all of us.
Okay, many thanks.
Thanks. Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming along. It's interesting that how a figure like Thunderbolt can attract so much controversy in New South Wales and in Australia, but also an important figure in 19th century New South Wales and Australian history. So well done to Carol Baxter on the occasion of the publication of the book Captain Thunderbolt and His Lady, and Janet Grundy's got copies of that. And thanks to David for giving a historian's interpretation of conspiracy theories and the current conspiracy theory about Frederick Ward. So well done tonight, and your papers will be published in due course in the Sydney Papers online. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.